Hi everyone, good afternoon. For those who I haven't met, my name is David Bell, I'm the CEO of the Actors Institute. Welcome to our third plenary session, which has a very weighty topic of foundations, capital, regulation and policy. As we know, the interconnectivity of capital markets is a spur to economic growth, but it also creates potential for future financial instability. The Financial System Inquiry pointed out, quote, as the banking sector is at the core of the Australian financial system, its safety is of paramount importance, unquote. I'm sure we agree that building and maintaining the resilience of the banking system is crucial. Now, to continue that theme, we've got three terrific speakers. Now, we've all been at conferences where the dross is at the end. Well, let me tell you, we might be at the tail end, but we have not got three tail enders here. We've got some heavy hitters. So we've got three terrific speakers. First up will be Kevin Davis of FSI fame and other things, Wayne Byers, who's the chairman of APRA, and Stephen Munchenberg, who's the CEO of the Bankers Association. And all of those people, in their different ways, are at the heart of discussions about how to reduce the risk of bank failure and reduce the costs of such an event. Each of those people will be speaking for 20 minutes, then there'll be questions at the end. So our first speaker is Kevin Davis. Kevin is a professor of finance. Now, you're at the University of Melbourne, aren't you, Kevin? Good. And Monash. That's what confused me, how you could have two hats. Obviously, no competition there? None at all. He's also very well known for being a panel member of the Financial System Inquiry, which concluded last year or the year before. It does. So Kevin was absolutely at the heart of what was happening with the financial system. So we're very privileged to have Kevin. Please welcome Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. Let me just pull up some overheads. I have a set of overheads that relate to a particular research paper, and I'm going to dip into them from time to time. But I thought, actually, I should start. Nicolette talked about her career guidance about becoming an actuary. I had 5 minutes guidance as well. When I was studying econometrics at Adelaide University as an undergraduate, Peter Prates, who was an actuary, was teaching econometrics and talked to me about becoming an actuary. I gave it 5 minutes thought, decided I'm never going to get a proper job, so I just stayed in academia. Never got a proper job. In the context of the Financial System Inquiry, a lot of people have mentioned the words unquestionably strong. And I'm going to start with that and come back to it at the end. But clearly one of the things that's happened in the context of strengthening the banking system, trying to make sure that banks are safe, is all the changes associated with Basel III. And one of the aspects of the Basel III changes has been the introduction of bail-in requirements for any securities other than common equity that are going to be counted as regulatory capital. So if you want a security to be additional Tier 1 regulatory capital or Tier 2 regulatory capital, it has to have what are referred to as bail-in provisions. And this is meant to try and stop what we saw of governments having to bail out the banks. So what I want to do is, and they've become very popular, become popular with Australian banks and overseas, and they're also very complex. And so what I want to do in this session is to talk a bit about those securities and explain what they are, talk a little bit about the Australian market. One of the things I'm going to stress is that once we start to think about these securities, we're actually not in the world of risk that all you guys love. We're in the world of uncertainty. You've probably all come across Frank Knight's, the famous Chicago economist, discussion of uncertainty rather than measurable risk, or Donald Rumsfeld's known unknowns and unknown unknowns. And I sort of classify the known unknowns as being probabilistic risk, the modelling and so on, and the unknown unknowns is, we just haven't got a clue. And that's actually what these things are all about, in my opinion. It's a problem we face with these types of instruments. I think it's also a problem we face generally with bank regulation, and I'm also going to argue that maybe we've gone too far in thinking that we're too smart in the context that we can actually model lots of aspects of risk. We're designing very complex risk management systems and regulations based around the notion that we can actually model risk, when actually a large part of the problem is just the uncertainty of the future. We can't predict what's going to happen, and maybe we should be thinking about some simpler types of approaches, more robust and hopefully simpler approaches. And I know that Wayne will pick up on my comments there, because clearly you need to worry about risk, but I think uncertainty is very fundamental. So In that context of talking about risk and uncertainty, I should also mention I've just been reading over the last few days the recent book by Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, and it's called Alchemy and Something About Banks. And he's very strong on this notion that we should actually be thinking about uncertainty rather than risk, and that has lots of implications in terms of what we should do in terms of regulation. Okay, so what I do in this paper, which is a joint paper with Michael Saber from Evans and Partners, is to try and ask the question, if you were buying one of these bail-in securities, what sort of risk premium should you demand? You know, what is the risk involved, or what is the uncertainty involved, and how much should you demand? Does the market actually provide appropriate compensation for the risk involved? So let me get into it and very quickly slip through some of these slides. What I'm talking about is these types of securities that some of you may know and love and might have even bought some of them. I've bought some of them. And I'm not going to give you any investment guidance whatsoever, any of these things whatsoever. But these are the sorts of securities that banks have been issuing, I would say hand over fist almost. They've become very popular. So I've got an outline there of things that I might cover, but I probably won't. Let me get straight into it. What are these securities? Bail-in securities, they're hybrid debt or preference shares. In Australia, they tend to be preference shares because we have a dividend imputation tax system, and therefore preference shares are as good as debt or better. They're securities which will convert mandatorily into some specified amount of ordinary shares, or they'll be written off if some trigger event occurs. Now, lots of academics have studied this type of issue, but they've actually done it in a world completely different to the real world, which is pretty common with academics. So there's been lots of discussion of what are referred to as COCOs, convertible contingent securities, where the trigger event is that the bank share price hits some lower bound, and then these securities will convert, a $100 security will convert into some amount of equity. In the case of the real world, what we have is contingent capital, bail-in securities, as required by the Basel Committee for inclusion of these securities to meet the regulatory capital requirements. And this is part of the strengthening of capital requirements that the Basel Committee has been on about. As I said, in the academic literature, the trigger is a lower price. If the price falls enough, these things convert. In the real world, what happens is either if the bank's common equity tier 1 ratio to risk-weighted assets hits 5.125, and several people have tried to explain to me why it's 5.125, and I can never manage to keep it in my head as to why it is that number. If either you get that outcome, or if Wayne wakes up one morning and says, I think that bank's at a point of non-viability, that's when conversion occurs. So, the types of bail-in securities effectively are, they convert into a fixed value of shares. There's a few sort of tail-end risks associated with that, where if the share price is really, really, really low, then the investors won't get it. Well, there's a maximum number of shares. But actually, in general, the specifications, they convert into a fixed value of equity. If it's a $100 security, it converts into $100 of equity. But there's a real sting in the tail associated with that question of what do you mean by the value of $100 of equity, which I'll come to in a second. They were introduced as part of the Basel stuff. You know, there were some before that. They're going to become more and more important once the TLAC provisions come into play for globally systemically important banks, and I would assume also for our domestically systemically important banks that there will be TLAC requirements, and these will be one of the ways of meeting those requirements. They're already significant. If you look, for example, at ANZ, ANZ's got 5 billion of these on issue. They only started issuing them in 2011. Out of 32, compared to 32 billion of common equity, so about a sixth of the size of the common equity. If you look at the size of the market in Australia, just purely those ones that are listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, sold mainly to retail investors, and the other ones put into the wholesale markets, that's already around about 30 billion. That's 60% of the size of the domestic non-financial corporate bond market. Which has been going forever, been struggling forever, actually, I think it's a better statement. It's already grown really quite substantially. What is it that I'm trying to do in this paper? I'm trying to estimate what is the risk premium. How much should an investor require over and above a Commonwealth Government bond rate or above the rates in other equivalent securities to try and to make it worthwhile taking on the risk / uncertainty associated with these securities? Of course, this is a little bit different to a credit risk premium. What happens if a company fails and defaults on the bond? Because what happens here is it doesn't fail, well, it might fail eventually, but these things get converted into equity, And the question is, what might you lose if that happens? And let me get over that. Let me first of all just tell you a bit about the market, just so you're aware of that this is not a small, insignificant area. On that slide, I've got by half year, starting in 2011, second half, the number of issues by the Australian banks in the red, or is it red, whatever colour that is, the stripe one, and the green one. I can tell, I'm slightly colourblind, but sort of the green one is the amount. So you can see the rough, I'm not allowed to go over there, am I? That basically, in sort of 2013, 2014, in each half year there was about four issues and the total amount was $4 billion issued. Typically the big banks would do over $1 billion, the smaller banks would do under $1 billion. I haven't got in there the most recent ANZ one, which was announced only a few weeks ago, but there was two the first half of this year. One of the things that's worth knowing is that they're directed largely towards retail investors, and what I've got on that slide is from the statements when they are issued. The things I've circled are the percentage of the issue taken up by investors who invest less than 500,000, and you can see in the first circle there, it's at 38 and 23. Your actuaries, you can do it. It's something like 61, isn't it? 61% is taken up by retail investors, and they're investing relatively small amounts. So there is lots of issues to retail investors. So what are the particular characteristics of these securities? Generally, they're issued with franking credits, so you merely get a complication in terms of how you understand them. So if, for example, if you look at that formula for the coupon, bank bill swap rate plus some specified margin that's worked out in the book build times 1 minus the corporate tax rate. So what happens is some part of it is a cash payment and some part of it is franking credits. So if, for example, the bank bill swap rate was 4%, if the margin was another 5%, that gets you up to 9%. But then you multiply it by 1 minus the corporate tax rate, which is 0.7. That means 9 times 0.7, you get 6.3 in the form of a cash payment, and the other 2.7, whatever the difference is a franking credit. That means, of course, for these securities, they're all retail, all Australian investors. Foreign investors don't want it because the franking credits are of no use to them. In general, they're non-cumulative, perpetual, blah, 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 blah. But one of the things we know is that the banks have a call option available to them after 6 years where they can call those securities back at the par value, and they will, provided they can, because otherwise, if they don't, they'll convert into common equity, and banks, bless their heart, believe these things are much cheaper than common equity, and therefore they want to roll them over into a new form of common equity. The rest of it I think you've seen. So, first question, how would you value these securities? Typically what you do, if you're a banker, is you say, let's look at the probability of default and the loss given default and take that into account. What's the probability of default? What's the probability of one of these things actually being bailed in? God knows. Wayne might, but the rest of us don't. Because basically it comes down to the regulator making a decision saying this bank's at a point of non-viability. Also, in the context of what actually happens for a bank, you could imagine what's going to happen if a bank thinks it's getting towards a point of non-viability. It's going to issue new equity. So trying to assess what's the probability of bail-in as an investor, it's got to be really hard. This is pure uncertainty. What about the outcome? What happens if it's bailed in? Well, the standards line of these things, $100 security gets converted into $100 of equity. But it's $100 of equity at the valuated average price over the 5 days prior to the announcement and conversion. So at the date of, just before the announcement, the average price has been $20, $100 share, security gets converted into 5 shares. Go to the stock market the next morning. What are you going to be able to sell those shares for? I'm pretty sure it ain't going to be $20. There's going to be some loss. We've got no idea what that loss will be. It's complete uncertainty as to what will be the loss. Of course, people still have to try and estimate the price of these things, and they do. They trade in the market. And so one of the things that I try and do in this paper, I'm not going to bore you with it, is to estimate what is the way in which, how do people value the securities? How do they work out what is an appropriate risk premium? What is the size of that? And there's some calculations there. I think these slides might be available, or I can make them available afterwards together with the paper if anyone wants to go into those numbers. But we spend some time in the paper trying to estimate that. Part of the problem in trying to estimate that is the problem that's shown in this diagram. That basically from the middle of 2014, the premium on these securities just went through the roof. Not quite through the roof, went from the cellar to sort of somewhere on the upper deck. So there's something happened in the middle of 2014 which meant that the market changed its perception of these securities. It might be just the fact that there was a huge lot of issuance of them and supply meets demand, and therefore the prices, the premiums had to go up for people to be willing to invest in them, or it could be that people became familiar with the risks and slash uncertainty. Who knows? So there was some re-rating of the bail-in risk. Let me skip that slide. That's an academic type slide that you don't want to know about. But I think there's a number of issues that come out of all of this. One is these are securities that are characterised by uncertainty rather than the sort of modelable, is that a word? Modelable risk that you guys love. We're encouraging the issuance of very complex securities that are almost impossible to value. The rationale is that by doing this, we are strengthening the capital position of banks because we have these bail-in securities that will convert into equity. In principle, that's a really great idea. In practice, when push comes to shove, one has to ask what will actually happen, particularly if it's a whole lot of retail investors. Superannuation funds that are picking up these securities, will the government be willing to bail in those securities, or will we have the situation that we see overseas that even though there is commitment of governments, or at least commitment of governments to have bail in, we'll see bailouts rather than that occurring. So I think that's an important issue. A second issue is are the prices at which retail investors buying these things fair? The answer is we don't know, but there's lots of sophisticated investors out there who probably are saying that. And part of the question there is, do the retail investors actually know what they're getting into? Even if the pricing is fair, if the institutional investors that are participating in the market can work out what is a fair price for the uncertainty or risk involved, the retail investors might be getting a fair price, but they may not know what risk they're taking. And that's just as bad, it seems to me, as them not getting a fair price. So I think there's a number of complications with these things. A lot of people argue that these things can help in identifying problem banks before they get into a problem because the prices of these securities, in principle, should reflect the risk associated with the banks and the risk of bail-in. That's certainly not showing up at the moment in the data, but that may be just the fact that it's new, and hopefully our Australian banks are so far away from any potential bail-in that actually the premium is pretty small. They're also being introduced primarily because they can help with the resolution of a troubled bank. You get that automatic conversion of these securities into common equity, which boosts the capital base of the bank, enables a sensible resolution of the bank if it has to be wound down or if it has to be sold off or whatever, and overcomes that problem. Will it actually happen? What will happen when push comes to shove? We just don't know. We don't have enough experience yet. So let me come back to sort of the basic point that I started with about the need to have strong, unquestionably strong banks and the issue of risk and uncertainty. What's happened over the years is that we have put more and more emphasis on risk modelling and basing our capital requirements around an assumption that we can model risk and understand risk. Mervyn King in his book makes the point that maybe we should just be going for stronger and simpler. Why not just have a leverage ratio right up here? If banks had 100% equity capital, we wouldn't have to worry about sort of banks failing. It's a bit extreme, but there's some level of equity capital where, in a sense, the risk of them failing gets down sufficiently low that maybe you don't have to worry about it. Now, I think worrying about risk is very important, and we certainly can't get completely away from incorporating risk into the capital requirements and into analysis of bank safety. But it does seem to me we've gone too far thinking we're too clever and end up with very, very complex regulation, which I can't keep on top of myself, and I'm supposed to be an academic specialising in these things. Maybe there is simpler, better ways of doing this stuff. And that's where I sort of think, why don't we just put in place a leverage ratio of 15% rather than allowing banks to have equity to total assets of 5%? I know that lots of people will object to that, but hey, I'm ready for a fight. Thanks. Thank you.
you can sit over there, downplaying the importance of risk is very dangerous in a room like this, Kevin. Our next speaker is Wayne Byers, who everyone knows is the chairman of APRA. Wayne's early career was at the Reserve Bank, where he spent 13 years, I believe, and that included as a commitment to the Bank of England. He transferred to APRA on its establishment and has held any number of the senior positions there, including the top job. Prior to becoming the chairman, he was Secretary General of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. He's also APRA's representative on the Australian Council of Financial Regulators, the Payment Systems Board, the Trans-Tasman Council on Banking Supervision, the Basel Committee and its oversight body, the Governors and Heads of Supervision. An impressive resume. This bloke knows his regulation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and thank you to the Institute for the opportunity to be part of this year's event. I think the Institute's increasing engagement on banking-related matters is it's a welcome development, and as was the case last year, very happy to support the event today. I'm going to, though, follow Kevin's lead in that the theme for today is banking on capital. I'm going to talk about something a bit different. I'm going to talk about what happens when there's not enough capital, which was largely what Kevin was alluding to. So, in fact, you know, when, one of the important things about the post-crisis reforms, and even in Sean Dooley's comments earlier on, there was a recognition that a sole reliance on capital to solve everything is actually a quite unwise strategy. And failures can happen. And so, as my title slide alludes to, we need to think about how to find success in failure. So we've already heard the term unquestionably strong many times today. Over the past couple of years, since the FSI report was launched, there's been quite justifiably a lot of attention given to that the implications of that first recommendation of the FSI, that we should set capital standards such that authorised deposit-taking institutions, or ADIs as we call them, have capital ratios that are seen to be unquestionably strong. Now, there's been a lot written and said about what that means, and given it's going to be a little while before we're in a position to make a final determination about how we best implement that recommendation, no doubt more will be written and said about it. Today, I'm simply going to repeat something that I've said previously, and that is in the current environment that the sort of continued steady accumulation of capital remains a sensible course of action for most ADIs. It's always important to remember, though, that a stable and resilient financial system, banking system, is not just delivered by more capital. Capital adequacy, it's a relative concept. Is capital adequate relative to risk? And so when we talk about a bank's capital being high or low or something in the middle, we're making a judgment that takes into account all manner of factors that impact on a bank's risk profile. So funding and liquidity, asset quality, governance, risk management, risk culture, to name a few, are all things that come into the equation in some way or another. We also need to remember, though, that there's no guarantees. I think, as Kevin alluded to, no level of capital short of 100% equity is going to provide creditors with an absolute guarantee against the possibility of bank failure. So to come back to our banking on capital theme, we can't. Something can always go wrong. And to attempt to provide the community with some kind of ironclad guarantee that nothing can go awry, it would require such severe limitations on the risk-taking ability of the banking system that it's simply not feasible. It would prevent it from fulfilling the sort of vital and productive roles that it plays in intermediating between borrowers and lenders, and also facilitating the smooth functioning of payments throughout the economy. So in the regulatory jargon, we talk about a zero failure regime is not desirable. So inevitably, therefore, we need to find a balance. And one implication of that is even once we define and the banks achieve unquestionably strong, we can't down tools. In a world of fractional reserve banking, which is what we have, unquestionably strong is never going to equate to invincible. So that in turn means we need to think about failure. And when I use the word failure, I'm not just talking about a classic case of an insolvency or a bankruptcy, but using it more broadly to capture situations in which, you know, one or more financial institutions is in serious jeopardy. Now, as we all know, failure of a bank is not like the failure of a bakery. The potential for contagion to other financial firms and the potential for widespread adversity that can be imposed on the broader community means that the failure or near failure of a bank is certainly not any kind of run-of-the-mill matter. So if we start with the proposition that failures are inevitable, then I'd suggest that the regulatory system needs to be assessed against two benchmarks. First of all, are failures nevertheless sufficiently rare? And do we have mechanisms to handle them adroitly when they occur? And if the answer to both of those questions is yes, then community confidence and trust in the financial system is likely to remain high. So with that in mind, we can sort of think about two basic types of failure, orderly and disorderly failures. So orderly failures, to the extent that we have failures, orderly failures are what we aspire to. Doesn't mean we want failures, but to the extent we have to have them, we want them to be orderly. Orderly failures, typically, they've been anticipated, they produce no loss to protected creditors, and they're managed in such a way that the failing firm's critical functions are maintained without disruption while the situation is resolved. Shareholders and other providers of capital of the non-viable firm may very well lose out along the way, but that's their lot in life. To the extent that any failure can be regarded as a success, then an orderly exit from the industry in this sort of fashion is what we should strive for. So, for example, a firm that identifies its approaching non-viability or it's heading into a strategic dead end and seeks to merge with a stronger and more viable entity and sometimes with a nudge along the way from the regulator, that's a far from uncommon event in the Australian financial system. And to the extent such failures or such exits can be classed as failures or at the very least near failures, they're often so orderly that no one even notices them. Disorderly failures, on the other hand, are to be avoided. Disorderly failures are those catch everyone by surprise. They impose significant losses on those creditors that the regulatory framework is intended to protect, and or they involve significant disruption to the smooth operation of the financial system and economic activity more generally. And HIH insurance is obviously the classic of this sort of genre. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, what can we do to maximise the probability that failures, to the extent we have them, will be orderly rather than disorderly? Well, I'd suggest a number of preconditions that the public sector needs to put in place to promote orderly failures and try to seek to avoid disorderly failures. So first of all, we have to have active supervision. It's at the heart of identifying the risk of failure early. It's obviously hard to anticipate problems if there's no one looking for them in the first place. There need to be powers to intervene. It's critical to being able to address small problems before they become big ones, to have the capacity to intervene. You have to also have a willingness to intervene. Powers are of no value if there's no capacity or no willingness to use them when they're needed. We want to have undertaken planning and preparation, so ideally we'll have contingency plans that have been prepared and tested in peacetime, rather than thought up on the run in the midst of a crisis. We need a capacity to maintain critical functions. An orderly resolution of a failure may take time, yet critical functions need to be maintained in the interim. And then there should ideally be a safety net or backstop to provide additional confidence in times of uncertainty. And we want that to help avoid actions which are individually rational but collectively damaging. And the obvious case being a bank run, which is perfectly rational for those who are standing in the queue to get their money, but collectively damaging for the community. So we at APRA, along with our colleagues on the Council of Financial Regulators, have spent a lot of time in recent years looking in a fairly hard-nosed way at how Australia stacks up against these preconditions. If I had to summarise the conclusion, I'd say they're somewhat mixed. There's no glaring deficiencies, no obvious glaring gaps, but there's a number of areas that we can improve on. So the importance of active supervision and the willingness to intervene where appropriate, they were some of the hard lessons that APRA took to heart following the HIH episode. Justice Owen, who was the HIH Royal Commissioner, found APRA under-resourced to identify problems and slow to respond to them once found. Now, they were fair conclusions, and APRA certainly worked hard under my predecessor as chairman to build both its capacity and its conviction. 15 years on from HIH, efforts to further improve our supervision, to identify risks early and to respond promptly, remain at the forefront of our latest strategic plan. I suspect they're always going to feature prominently in APRA's priorities. When it comes to powers to intervene, the FSI final report noted there were some gaps in and deficiencies in the Australian statutory framework for crisis management and resolution when compared with international standards. So that includes the need for such things as broader investigation powers, some strengthened direction powers, enhanced powers to deal with branches of foreign banks, some more robust immunities for statutory and judicial managers, and a range of technical things. A good news was that in his speech last week, the Treasurer noted the government's intention to make improvements in this area, to bring legislation to the Parliament. And we see those as a very valuable and actually low-cost investment in the stability of the financial system. Oops. Crisis planning is obviously critical. Last year at this event, I spent a bit of time talking about our plans in the area of recovery and resolution planning. During the past year, I'm pleased to say that the larger ADIs have all submitted new plans based on some updated guidance that we had issued, and we're now going through the process of reviewing and benchmarking those plans in order to highlight areas of better practice and seek to further increase the credibility of the plans in subsequent iterations. And on the resolution planning side of things, some more detailed work's also underway with specific firms to consider the planning required to ensure we are able to use our powers when they're needed. And so here it's things like making sure we're clear about what are the critical functions that need to be maintained, what are the intergroup dependencies in a corporate group, things like critical shared services, and also the identification of potential barriers to resolvability. All that planning is good, all that planning is important, but no matter how good the plan, stabilising and restructuring a financial firm that's no longer viable in its current form is rarely going to be a quick and easy exercise. So it's important that while the resolution plan's being implemented, the firm's critical functions can be maintained, whereas you want to reduce potential losses and minimise the disruption to the broader community. Key to doing that is that the firm has the financial resources to allow it to continue to operate while the business is being reorganised. Now, searching for new capital when a business is distressed and time is of the essence is never a good strategy. Ideally, we want to avoid that. We also want to minimise the risk that the taxpayer has to come to the rescue. So with that in mind, and as Kevin's already alluded to, the post-crisis regulatory framework has built mechanisms that trigger automatic corrective action as a bank's capital starts to diminish. There's a lot of discussion and debate about the merits of bail-inable instruments and bailing powers, and including in response to the FSI's recommendation that we should build a framework of greater recapitalisation capacity sufficient to facilitate the orderly resolution of an Australian ADI and minimise the potential for taxpayer support. But as Kevin's pointed out, that concept of bail-in is not just a concept. Certain recapitalisation mechanisms already exist in the capital framework that we have today. I've called out three there, two Kevin alluded to previously, but there's sort of three steps in the process, if you like, in the current framework. So first of all, there's the capital conservation buffer, which imposes limitations on a bank's ability to make discretionary distributions to capital providers and employees as the capital ratio declines and approaches its minimum regulatory requirement. And the short answer to Kevin's question on why 5.125% is this sort of strange number to be a trigger point is simply that's the bottom quartile of the... once you enter the bottom quartile of the buffer, that's the trigger for action. Second mechanism that we have is this trigger that exists in additional Tier 1 capital instruments, the hybrids, that provide for the instrument. Here I'll complicate Kevin's little explanation as well and make it even harder for him to price these instruments, because, in fact, you could have three things happen when you hit this trigger. There's provision within for banks to issue instruments that convert into equity in the failing bank. Convert to equity in a parent institution, or are completely written off. And so not all of those instruments, I suspect, Kevin, you were looking at in your study and necessarily have the same trigger mechanism. So that's another area of complexity. Nonetheless, these exist in these instruments, and as capacity, when capital ratios decline, hit that level, they are converted or written off. Either way, they create new equity in the bank. And then finally, there's the point of non-viability trigger in both additional Tier 1 and Tier 2 instruments that provides for the instruments to be again written off or converted to equity in the event that we consider the ADI would become non-viable without that action. Now, those latter two mechanisms are designed to provide breathing space to allow for an orderly resolution of whatever problems the bank is encountering. They're not designed to deliver a resurrection. It's not designed to deliver a brand new, perfectly healthy bank. But more modestly, to provide scope for the ADI services to customers and the critical functions to continue while new owners and managers are being put in place. We will need to strengthen that further to take up the FSI recommendation about some additional recapitalisation and loss absorbing capacity. That remains a work in progress and can take some time to complete. As I've said elsewhere, we're hastening slowly in response to that recommendation because it is important to get the policy settings right. However, the new mechanisms that have already been instituted within the existing capital framework are already an important part of the regulatory apparatus we have in place. Viewing those sorts of capital instruments as simply higher yielding substitutes for vanilla fixed interest investments, or let alone viewing them as alternative to deposits, is something you really should be counseled against, since from our perspective, these instruments are designed to provide very important first lines of defence that we can call into action, in some instance, even ahead of shareholders, to aid an orderly resolution. Finally, despite all of these new mechanisms, it is important that we have a good safety net backstop to provide additional confidence before and during a period of resolution. Australian depositors have long had the benefit of depositor preference provisions in the Banking Act. In 2008, the government instituted or supplemented that with the Financial Claims Scheme, FCS, which seeks to provide certain deposits with prompt access to their money in the event a bank fails, up to $250,000 per account holder, as I said, in the event that a bank fails. But to achieve the prompt payout of protected depositors, which is obviously something depositors must be confident in for the bank's backstop to work as intended, it actually requires ADIs to be operationally ready prior to any failure to meet all of the payment and reporting and communication requirements for the financial claims scheme. Planning and investing to facilitate their own demise is actually something that, understandably somewhat, financial firms actually find difficult to do. And so we'll be, in the next little while, doing some more work to reinforce expectations in relation to testing programs, etc., to make sure that this backstop mechanism will work and there's a genuine readiness to activate it if it's ever needed. So let me just quickly sum up then. Adequate capital is undoubtedly critical to the stability of the banking system, and that's why it was recommendation number one of the financial system inquiry. But to pick up again on today's theme, we can't solely bank on capital. We can't solely bank on capital to deliver safety and stability. Something can still go wrong. And if we accept that failures, while hopefully still reasonably rare, are nevertheless an inevitable part of a competitive, dynamic financial system, then preparation to minimise their impact is an essential investment. So to return to my starting point, successful failures might seem something of a contradiction in terms, but I'd suggest they're far better than the alternative. So thank you very much.
Our final speaker for the day is Stephen Munchenberg, who's the CEO of the Australian Bankers Association, which is the organisation representing the banking industry in the development of public policy and regulation. The ABA works to improve public awareness of the banking industry's strong contribution to the economy and to ensure Australians continue to benefit from a stable and competitive banking industry. Stephen is also the chairman of the International Banking Federation and the Finance Council of Australia. He has over 30 years of experience in public policy in the private, public and not-for-profit sectors, and has held senior roles at the National Australia Bank and the Business Council of Australia. As I know well, Stephen is in the front line of all the difficult and contentious debates about banking today, be they capital adequacy, fees and charges, profitability, banking royal commissions. I'm sure you'll be saying something about all those things. Please welcome Stephen. Thank you.
So I think David said at the start that we keep the dross to the end. So it's always hard enough to be the last speaker of the day. But Wayne has given me some hope because he has given me a new ambition to shoot for in the next 20 minutes, which is orderly failure. So with that, just to start, we've heard a bit about capital, we've heard a bit about regulation, a little bit about policy. I'm not particularly going to speak about any of those. I learned long ago that when you've got a room full of experts, always talk about something completely different. So I'm actually going to talk about politics. And given the interest here, I'm going to talk about political risk. My sector does know a bit about political risk at the moment in particular. So I'm just going to sort of talk through some of the things that are going on driving the politics around the banking sector. I'm going to start sort of fairly large, though. So David mentioned that I used to work at the Business Council, and about a dozen years ago, the BCA was finding it difficult to get its message out. So whenever the BCA sort of said, we need this particular type of reform, at the time people tended to hear it as, that's in your interest, not necessarily in mine, in the community. And we did a lot of thinking, a lot of research, and a lot of work around that. And what we discovered a dozen years ago was that while the community is very sceptical of big business, They did accept that big business tends to think longer term. They tend to think longer term than governments. They tend to see themselves as going to be around for longer than any particular government. And they also do understand the economy. So you wouldn't be a successful big business if you didn't understand the economy. So the lesson out of that was, back a dozen years ago, when big business talked about, we need this particular reform in the long-term interest of the economy, then people would listen. They would see that as credible. So I'm going to start, and I'll talk then about specifically about my sector, by saying none of that holds true anymore. So an important lesson the business community needs to learn is no longer enough for us to go out and say, this is good for the economy and therefore it's good for you. Because people no longer accept, by and large, that what we say is good for the economy is necessarily good for the economy, rather than back thinking about it's actually good for us. And secondly, and more importantly, there are growing numbers of people in the community who say, just because it's good for the economy doesn't mean it's going to be good for us. Now, that is a big public policy reversal. For 30 years, through the 80s, through the 90s, particularly the work of people like Paul Keating, who drummed it into the Australian community that what is good for the economy, even if you feel it hurts you personally, is actually in the long run going to be good for people. And we've lost that. So that's a bit of a scene setting for when I come to talk about the banking sector. Now, I'll be using numbers as well, because of your actuaries, and obviously numbers are important. I'm sorry I can't put 5.125% into my presentation. I'll work on it as we go through. I'll be using the number 3, because I'm a simple guy. And there's a few things that I'll talk about where there are 3 important points. So I just sort of flag that in case your interest is flagging at any point. You'll be looking out for the next 3. So those of you who leap out of bed first thing in the morning, and who doesn't, to grab the Fin Review, flick straight through to the financial services section to see what the latest news is, or you've got your eyes glued to your inbox waiting for banking day to pop up with, you know, all the latest news, both those worthy journals being represented in the room, so a bit of sucking up doesn't hurt. And I've probably missed someone, and that's going to be a bad report tomorrow in that newspaper. But those of you who do that and who doesn't, you would be aware that there is some talk in some quarters of a Royal Commission into the banking sector. The rest of you aren't aware of that, take it as a given. I'd like to touch a little bit on what's driving that. I see there are 3 things, 3 primary forces that are driving this talk of a Royal Commission, and I'll come to explain then why the talk of a Royal Commission is so important. The first thing undeniably is there have been too many instances within the banking sector where we have failed to live up to our own standards, let alone those of the community. They're well known, they're well advertised, they're very real, and we have consistently acknowledged those problems and that we need to not only address the specific issues, but we need to learn the lessons from those problems. So undoubtedly there have been some specific issues in the sector, and we need to look very carefully at that and take those lessons. The second factor is that is affecting my sector is the same force that has caused Brexit, the same force that is driving Trump, the same force that is driving the far right, the rise of the far right across Europe, and that is that there is a significant and growing percentage of the population who feel that the current established order is letting them down. It is not delivering for them. In fact, they feel that typically they are working harder and harder and they are not getting on. But it's worse than that, because then they look at, on TV, as typically is still, regrettably, blokes in suits, expensive suits with nice silk ties, saying the economy is going really well and we need economic reform to keep things going. And they're sitting there saying, I'm not part of that. I don't believe that story anymore. This has been publicly reported about, so it's no great revelation. But you know, the Prime Minister, the end of last year, very rightly highlighted the need for Australia to be innovative. We are increasingly a services-based economy. We need to be innovative. That's one of our competitive edges. But one of the things that, well, the consequences that flow from that, well, there's a lot of people out there, they might be fitters and turners who are worried about their job security, heard innovation, Silicon Valley, fintech, all this sort of stuff, and they felt that is just further evidence that this economy that everyone keeps talking about is leaving me behind. And that is a big factor, again, in the banks. So in a very simple level, people sort of feel they're working hard, they're worried about having to, you know, pay the mortgage, you know, there's incomes coming from 1.5 jobs in the in the family, if you like. So they've got sort of two jobs they're feeling insecure about, worrying about how they're going to raise the kids, meet the kids' costs, meet the mortgage payments, all of that sort of stuff. And then they see these big profitable banks who pay big salaries to executives, and they feel that somehow we are getting advantage out of the current system, they're not. And that's why in the extreme cases, and Brexit was an example of that, whatever the ins and outs of whether Europe should be in or out of the EU, but Brexit was a very deliberate rejection of the experts, of London, of all the people who said Europe is the right answer. A lot of people in Britain said, I don't care what you say, things are bad, you know, I don't believe they can get worse, so I'm going to take a punt on something completely different. And that is a very, very risky and destabilising thing in our political system. Then the third issue for us is a very specific one. And that is, this has been talked about publicly, those of you who, you know, when you weren't glued to the Fin Review or reading Banking Day, enjoyed the eight-week campaign that was up until the 2nd of July, will have noticed that a lot of Labour advertising was about the Prime Minister and suggesting that the Prime Minister is somehow out of touch with ordinary Australians. You know, the classic ad that ran pretty consistently was, maybe it's because the Prime Minister doesn't use these services, health, education, various other things, that he thinks it's okay to cut them. So, you know, a lot of the pushing for a Royal Commission at the moment is coming from the Labour Party, and they feel that by linking the Prime Minister to the banks, particularly bank CEOs, that's a great way to reinforce this sense that somehow the banks are out of touch. Well, sorry, the Prime Minister's out of touch with the community. So there's three things that are working on the industry. So from my point of view, there's not much I can do about two and three. So my focus is very much about what do we do on number one. So number one is this, you know, clearly we have an issue where the community sees what we do and doesn't like it. And there's a number of factors there. Now, I'm going to go for, come to another three in a moment. Well, actually, no, I'll come to another three now. Why not? There's actually one of the interesting things about the way the community views the banks is they actually have three different ways of thinking about banks in their minds simultaneously. So the way that they often will think about it is, I am a customer of Bank X, and I will have a view about Bank X. And by and large, that view is, you know, reasonably positive. So, you know, customer satisfaction figures close to high, record highs. You know, by and large, people are satisfied in one form or another with their bank, their own bank. But simultaneously, they think that all banks are not good. So they can say, my bank's okay, but all banks are bad. So what are they thinking there? They're thinking there about banks as a collection of institutions. And when they look at that, they judge that collection of institutions from different set of criteria. And typically that's where we see that the negative stories that have been persistent, unfortunately, are the ones that colour the views that people have about banks as a whole. The third area then is they actually do think a bit about banks as a system. So a system that underpins payments, that underpins the economy, that somehow helps businesses grow, develop and grow, helps them buy a house. They like the house, they don't like the mortgage that comes with it, but at least they get that we enable them to do that. Their credit cards, they may not like the interest rate, but they get that it enables them to manage their expenses or perhaps have things now that they can pay off over time. So they get that sort of enabling role of the banks. But it's not very front of mind. It's not the sort of thing that sort of leaps to mind. What tends to leap to mind when you ask people about banks, per se, is this collection of big profitable entities that are seen, and I'll come to a bit more on this, but are seen to sort of put their interests ahead of the customers. So we need to be very mindful that there is those three perspectives around the banks as well. So when it comes, I'll then pick out this one about, you know, how they view banks as a collective. So we've done a lot of research over the years to try and understand, you know, what drives this perspective. The short answer is that, you know, and this is not universal because people have all sorts of different views, but a significant portion of the population looks at the banks collectively and basically sees us as takers rather than as contributors. So they see that, they see what we take. They see the bank fees, they see the profits, and they equate that with what we take.
This is an issue that many intermediaries face. I mean, lawyers face a similar issue, doctors face a similar issue. No matter how positive people feel about their own doctor, doctors by and large are often seen as more interested in making money, and particularly specialists, and having seen a few recently, it's quite right too. That's another story for another day. That's the short answer. The more complex answer is that when they look at banks, they see us as occupying a privileged position in society. Now, we've acknowledged that publicly. We've said we get that banks occupy a privileged position. And there are three reasons. You notice the thing? There are three reasons primarily why they see banks as being privileged. The first one is we are a grudge purchase. You've got no choice but to be with a bank. It might be with a credit union or a building society, but it's a bank of some sort. It's pretty hard to get by in modern life without having some sort of relationship with the bank. So we're a bit of a grudge purchase, and we're not terribly exciting. The second reason, goes close to what Wayne was just talking about, is even though they know that our banks didn't have this experience, they know enough of what happened overseas to know that if all these highly paid, clever people who are running the banks stuff it up badly, it'll be the taxpayer who has to bail them out. So that still resonates with them. And then the third reason is the information asymmetry. So whether it's understanding about where the Australian economy or the global economy is going and therefore where to invest and how to manage that, or whether it's understanding the terms and conditions on this credit card that I'm signing up for, they feel that the bank is the one that has all the information and therefore has the power. Now, this touches on a very important point as well, because I get research from a number of different areas. I talk to the major political parties about their research. They're a bit more candid after elections than they are during them, but nonetheless, I talk about that. There are two sentiments or attitudes in the community at the moment that are driving a lot of what goes on. One is uncertainty. So people are feeling very uncertain about where the world is going and where their own lives are going. And the other is around loss of control. So people feel that they are losing control. That can manifest in all sorts of different ways. It can manifest, for older people, it's just the rate at which technology is taking over. So, they're still missing their checkbook, and all of a sudden you're telling me that, this is how I'm going to pay for things. So, right through to they look at the political system and think, you guys aren't even in control of what's going on. So this sense of uncertainty and control is very dominant in the community. And again, that then comes back to us. They feel that, we don't have any control in our relationship with the bank. We don't have any, there's uncertainty for us about, our futures, our financial futures. So that's sort of a picture of where we're at. And in that environment, going back to my sort of original three points, we can well understand why it is that something like a Royal Commission is popular. And it is undoubtedly popular. I mean, my own polling shows that if you ask people, would you like to have a Royal Commission into the banks, 2/3 of people say, yeah, sure, why not? Give the big banks a bit of a whack. Some of them may have thought through a bit more than that, but our research suggests not a lot more than that. And that's sort of the accumulation of a lot of these things, the issues that we've created for ourselves, this broader context in Western democracies that's going on, the politics around this, long-standing views about banks as well. So for those who are interested, I can show you some material written in the 1860s in Australia about what a pack of bastards the banks are. So there's obviously a long build to recover from these issues. So where does that then leave us? Well, we have deep and genuine concerns about a Royal Commission. We are not concerned about the scrutiny it brings. We are actually one of the most probably the most scrutinised industry in Australia, to be honest. There is never a day goes by that there aren't stories about banks in the media. There's rarely a day goes by where I don't speak to the media. So we've got a high level of scrutiny already. And then, given our important role in society and the economy, that's fine. That's appropriate. We have a high level of scrutiny through parliamentary inquiries. We've had 5 in just the last term of government. Varying numbers, depending on how you count them, but between more than a dozen up to 20, particularly if you pick up the FSO, which I'll mention in a moment. Since the GFC. The FSI was the most thorough inquiry into the whole financial system in 17 years. I've got to say that, 18 months after the report was handed down, an awful lot of people in the political world seem to have forgotten we've even done it. Sorry, Kevin, but you know, work is continuing behind the scenes. But if you listen to the rhetoric, people would forget we'd even done it. So we are. It's not the scrutiny. The things that concern us are the uncertainty. So when you have the leader of the opposition saying, "I want a royal commission to drive the systemic and structural and cultural change that needs to be, you know, driven through this industry," what does that mean? I mean, that generates a great deal of uncertainty. When he's pressed, he is not able to explain in detail what the issues are. I understand, I actually get, I'm on the receiving end of a lot of the community's frustration with the banks. I understand that. But why is a Royal Commission the answer? We've not heard that from proponents of the Royal Commission. And I am also concerned about the risk. So the risk for me is not so much risk in, you know, if this is the new normal, then the risk is not in the normal world. But I am haunted by my experiences through the financial crisis, as I'm sure many of us are one. I remember a time back in 2008 when I was sitting in the office of the then chief executive of the National Australia Bank. And I'd only been working in the bank for about 18 months. I arrived just in time in banking for the financial crisis. Timing is everything. And he said to me, "We discover tonight whether the rest of the world is going to stop lending to Australia." I knew a lot less about markets and what went on in treasuries, the sort of thing that Sean's people do all night on this sort of stuff. So, oh, this will be interesting. So I saw him the next morning, and he smiled, and I said, "Well, I assume that means they're still lending." And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Great. What would you have done if they hadn't been?" He said, "Oh, we would have stopped lending." So clearly, I mean, I can only assume that we were rolling over a large amount of money offshore at that point. But the lesson for me was that we can never, ever take for granted international confidence in what is, in fact, one of the world's best banking systems. So one of the real concerns I do have is, given the fragility of the world globally, if we have another crisis of some sort, and given that fragility, it would be a brave person who ruled out that possibility, when suddenly and markets start getting extremely nervous, suddenly start, you know, freezing up and everything, when they look at Australia, what we expect them to see is a very well capitalised, very well regulated and very well managed banking system. We already, however, have international investors asking our CEOs, "What's wrong with the Australian banking system that we don't understand? Because otherwise, why would you be going for the nuclear option?" I better say something nice about the Australian in a minute, because I just realised they're in the room as well. Fine sterling publication. What is wrong, fundamentally wrong, with the Australian banking system that we don't understand? Now, we will do a lot of work to explain to them, you know, look, there are issues in the industry. The industry itself is doing a lot of work to fix those things, but there's politics around this as well. But given our experiences with trying to persuade international investors that we aren't sitting on a housing bubble, which has been an ongoing piece of work and a hard piece of work, you know, we cannot be complacent about our ability to explain to them that, in fact, we do have one of the best, if not best, banking systems in the world. So there are some real risks around this. So to finish up with very quickly, because I'm probably out of time, none of this is to say we do not get that there are issues. But the point we need to keep making is we need to be fixing those issues now. We have announced a whole range of ways in which we are fixing those things. We've announced governance arrangements around that because, you know, we recognise that part of the issue is, if you don't trust us to do the right thing, why would you trust us to fix the issues? So we've put governance around that. In fact, a former Auditor General, Commonwealth Auditor General, is keeping a very close watch on us and will express his views on how we're doing publicly on a quarterly basis. So we're fixing the issues. We will continue to battle the political risk, but I just wanted to sort of run through that, give you a little bit of a context as to what's happening. But for me, you know, what are the broader lessons that are coming out of the experiences that we're going through? So I did my 3-3, so it's time for me to shut up and go. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. If the three presenters could sit up the front, we now have time for questions and answers. So three different presentations. It's going to be interesting to hear the sort of interaction we have amongst those presentations. When you ask your question, please state your name and where you're from, and Liz will have a couple of microphones to go around. Are there any questions for any of our presenters? Yes, we have one here. The media.
Thank you. John Kavanagh from Banking Day. Could I ask, Kevin, given what you've said, do you think that hybrid securities should be sold only to sophisticated investors or institutional investors and not retail investors?
I think there are risks to lots of retail investors. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of them is that the new issues of them are the last three or four, have only been available to existing shareholders or holders of other bank securities. So they haven't been made available in the initial public offering as a general issue. So there's a limit there in terms of that. But then they're tradable on the stock exchange. And I guess I have mixed feelings. I mean, it seems to me that if people want to go and buy securities on the stock exchange, it's up to them. We shouldn't stop them. But it does seem to me that we shouldn't be encouraging the creation of very complex securities that it's very hard for people to value. So I don't think I've managed to duck your question, actually.
Other questions? I'll just get one here first, and then we'll go to you.
Paul Harding Davis, Australian Unity. Question, in part for Wayne, perhaps in part for Stephen. The Treasurer was fairly slow to bring out, in response to the Royal Commission, the sort of analysis that showed that ASIC actually had overall probably more powers than a Royal Commission had anyway. And he was quite silent on the important role that APRA plays behind the scenes with, in terms of supervising banks and regulating banks and protecting the Australian banking customer. And the horse, in my view, the horse is probably bolted. Sorry, Stephen, I'm not sure that you could stop the momentum for a banking royal commission now. But nonetheless, I'm just wondering how much, I know you play a more silent role, but nonetheless, the community doesn't understand just how much you are doing behind the scenes to protect them, and that there would be value in that.
Well, I was trying to avoid any commentary on the Royal Commission. So, I think the focus on ASIC has been natural because, as Stephen alluded to, what's at the heart of many of these concerns that have been expressed has been individual consumer outcomes which have, you know, been unsatisfactory, and which in many cases the banks have fully accepted as being unsatisfactory. So that naturally turns the attention to ASIC, who is more of a consumer regulator. I mean, we have a more distant role ultimately looking after depositors, you know, insurance policy holders and fund members, but from a stability of the institution, stability of the system perspective, we're not at the forefront of consumer protection actions, and so it's natural that the focus is therefore is the regulatory agency that's specifically tasked with that. Does it have the adequate resources, powers, etc.? And that's what led to the Treasurer to talk about the powers ASIC had. It also was part of the impetus on which they were given additional funding, etc. So,
I was more trying to convey the message that there is far more supervision of the banks going on and regulatory coverage of the banks
than is understood in the community.
Yeah, it probably boils down to the challenge of getting through clear, sharp, impactful, simple messages. And it's easier to... I mean, there have been comments about the fact that we are one of the most regulated industries. You've got APRA, you've got ASIC, you've got the RBA with certain regulatory, AUSTRAC, a whole pile of things to some degree or other impact on this area. But I think it probably came down to, you know, as Wayne has alluded to, this is very customer, consumer-focused, and that's sort of ASIC's territory. It's a bit harder to sort of... I mean, obviously, APRA's got a very important role to play in conduct risk, which is very important within the banks, but it's sort of not the sort of thing that you're going to get, you know, cut through on, you know, the 7 o'clock news. So.
I think we had a question at the back here.
Hi there. It's James Ayres from the Financial Review, and just a question for you, Wayne.
In the wake of the last RBA cut to interest rates, you've seen a little bit of activity come back into the housing markets in Sydney and Melbourne, and auction clearance rates looking pretty healthy, which led a couple of prominent economists last week, Sawley Slake and Shane Oliver, just to suggest that the 10% growth caps or speed limits for investors might need to be looked at or continue to be enforced. I just wondered if you might speak a little bit about those caps. Do you think they're currently set at the right level, and is there any intention for you to move those caps? And secondly, just on lending standards and stability of the system in the low interest rate environment, I mean, do you think that the 7% stress buffer that the banks are currently using to assess a borrower's ability to repay their loans, sort of at a 7% interest rate, is that the right sort of rate to guard against instability as cash rate continues to fall?
So the December 2004 letter that we put out, which essentially said three things. We were looking for banks not to increase the proportion of lending that was at higher risk types, to strengthen serviceability standards, and if they're growing above 10% per annum investor lending, just to take the foot off the accelerator a bit. Now, all of those things are always under review because they were never intended to be permanent features of the landscape, or particularly the 10% growth number. I mean, so it was never intended to be permanent. I think, you know, Glenn Stevens in his speech the other day noted that sort of quantity type caps have never proven to be successful in the long run. So, well, that's effectively, you know, what this sort of measure is. So it has always intended to be temporary. It's still our view that it will be temporary. So we're certainly thinking about the next evolution of what we do. But I'd say it's served us well thus far. And it's all very well to say, oh, well, maybe that 10% cap could be a bit high and you could lower it by, you know, a couple of percentage points or something. But actual growth in investor lending at present is down near 5%. So, you know, I could lower the cap to 7%. I don't know what difference it really makes. And I think when it comes to the interest rate floors, 7% or 2 and a bit over the actual rate that you're borrowing at, I mean, I think they do serve a purpose. And the 7% number is a useful... it's a useful mechanism to keep serviceability standards at a certain level and not have those serviceability standards, in a sense, shift with general interest rate movements up and down. So I think, as I said, I think that's serving us well. Our objective, it's important to recognise too that our objective was not to determine house prices or set some target for the rate of growth in house prices. What we were trying to do was reinforce lending standards across the board, and we did that through making sure that serviceability standards and underwriting was good quality, and particularly with the investor growth benchmark, just taking some of the competitive heat out of the market that was causing people to, you know, push down on standards and erode standards. So our objective was not to predetermine where prices should be, but rather just make sure that the quality of lending was good and poor quality lending wasn't leading to excessive leverage in the system.
Thank you. Sorry, just at the back here, Michael Bennett from The Australian. Sorry, Wayne, another one for you. But today, I'm not sure if you saw, but there was another big jump in home loan approvals, including quite a large jump in New South Wales apartments. At a conference of probably a couple of months ago, Charles Luttrell noted that APRA had been sort of dialing up its supervision of commercial property lending by the banks. Can you give us an update on that and also your view of the risks out there, given talk of an apartment glut seems to just be getting louder?
So there's no doubt we have dialed up the intensity of our focus. And I think it's not just us. I mean, the Reserve Bank has called this out quite prominently in the Financial Stability Review in recent times. And, you know, in the history of banking, commercial property has always been front and centre whenever there's been any serious issues in the system. So it's natural that at times when valuations look to be on the high side, that we're making sure that the lending quality of the banks and the basis on which they're assessing credit is, you know, maintaining a fair, healthy degree of prudence about it. So we've actually followed similar process to what we've done on the housing side, but stopping short of putting some hard and fast benchmarks in place. We've been collecting data from all the banks. We're having a look at lending policies. We're providing them with some feedback on, you know, where perhaps their policies are more aggressive than some of their peers, because that's not always obvious to individuals in the market. The difficulty is commercial lending is far less homogenous than the standard housing loan lending, so it's more difficult to come up with some simple metrics that allow you to simply say, well, this bank's more aggressive than that bank. But nonetheless, that's what we're working through. You know, it's natural at this part of the cycle that supervisors are going to pay particular attention to it.
I have a question for Kevin. This is about the BIRPS, B-I-R-P-S, and being neither an actuary nor an academic, I probably didn't quite get what you were talking about. But you talk about the uncertainty of the loss associated with that instrument. So why are they so attractive?
I suspect partly because people don't think there's any risk of that actually happening, that given that the banks are pretty strongly capitalised, I don't think strongly enough, but my personal view, for them to get to a situation of a bail-in actually occurring, as Wayne said, they've got to go through the capital conservation buffer. That's sort of a... I can't imagine any bank executive wanting to get into that capital conservation buffer and not to be able to pay a dividend to their ordinary shareholders. And so you'd expect them to be trying to recapitalise at that point in time. So I suspect, you know, that... I mean, A, you could say it's that people just don't understand the risks, or it could be that people assess the risks as being very small. Okay. I guess the question then is, if that is the case, why is the risk premium as high as it is? Mm. And I'm still trying to work out the answer to that.
Okay. Oh, well. A few more years study.
I'm not giving any investment advice.
I think you are next. And then we'll...
Like I said, follow on a bit from Kevin's logic there. So it does feel like people would buy these things because it doesn't feel like there's mechanisms for it to actually drop below there. And probably not slowly either. So I'm really struggling. I've got some really ugly scribbles here. So I'm going to try and ask a question to Wayne. Bear with me. What measures do you think we have that will ensure that the any failure would actually be orderly? So on the back of that, I'm thinking about what Stephen said around... the commission happens, it could like have impacts on the confidence of the system. And if there's any sort of real material impact on the confidence of a system where you have more than half your balance sheet could be withdrawn in minutes, you know, breaking term deposits, people doing a run on the bank, I can't really see in my head without knowing what other measures we may be thinking about how you could actually orderly sort of go into this sort of zone. It all feels like it would happen pretty quickly to me.
So I think my couple of observations, I mean, you can always think of a scenario where all of a sudden your capital just falls through the floor. If you had a Nick Leeson bearing scenario, you have the something or other that can happen. I mean, I think, you know, hopefully that's very highly unlikely, but there is something that could happen that push you. The more likely scenario is you have some sort of economic downturn, repeat of the 1990s recession, significant declines in GDP, significant rises, double-digit employment. That's essentially what we tested in our most, a couple of years ago, in our most recent round of stress testing that we published in late 14. Yep. And we did find in that scenario that if left without any management mitigation, so if you just rode the scenario out, that some banks would have triggered the conversion of instruments. But that assumes management in that three-year period that it took for them to hit that point sat on their hands and do anything in response to a crisis scenario. And in fact, when you work through the recovery plans, which is another part of the important part of the framework, you know, people were taking action to shed assets, to raise extra capital, change pricing, do a range of things that that prevented them from getting to that trigger point in what was a quite severe scenario. So you would never say it couldn't happen, because I said you could have the rogue trader example, some kind of big fraud, whatever it might be. But the economic downturn scenario, which is the one that I think most people tend to think about in stress testing and the like, is going to happen over a period of time. And provided management doesn't sit on their hands and does something in response, then, you, as Kevin said, you would actually hope that that they're taking corrective action to avoid getting anywhere near that point.
So that that stress test exercise seemed pretty credit focused when it was conducted. Yeah. I guess things like the depositor guarantee probably help keep it credit focused rather than actually them trying to think about, you know, potential runs as well.
No, so I mean, one of the things that we've the focus today has been very heavily on capital. There's been a whole raft of strengthening to bank balance sheets in terms of their funding profile in the post-crisis period. Much greater use, or at its heart, a much, much reduced use of short-term wholesale money, particularly from offshore. So banks are lengthening the term of their wholesale funding, which I think someone spoke about earlier this afternoon. They've increased the proportion that comes from domestic deposits. So the reliance on offshore funding hasn't necessarily become a trivial point, but the reliance or the risk of, I think you used the phrase, which is probably a bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, half the money disappearing overnight, I mean, that sort of thing isn't a feasible scenario.
Okay, thank you. We might change gear here from the ether or the webinar for Stephen. From Rhonda Perry Macquarie, I think it's Macquarie Bank. There's a lot of negative publicity around decisions of banks not passing on full interest cuts. Why don't banks explain their decisions to the public rather than let them perceive that banks are being greedy? Come on, Stephen.
Yeah, should have thought
about when I was there, it was all okay?
Yeah. No. It's sort of gone downhill in the last 6.5 years, David. Thank you for that. Look, we do try to explain, and we have been successful in explaining. So, you know, it's been eight and a half years now since the banks first started moving interest rates independently of the RBA. I remember it well. NAB was the first one to do it, and I got the pleasure of ringing the new Treasurer, Wayne Swan, to break the news to him. And that message has got through. The challenge we've got now is, so if we go out and talk to people in the community, they'll say, I get that it's something to do with funding costs and that's why the banks haven't passed it on, but they're so profitable that they can afford to suck up the higher costs. They don't need to pass it on to me. So, you know, in essence, that message is getting through. It's the message gets through. It's still not liked, I suppose. So people still feel a sense of entitlement to whatever the interest rate movement is, at least on the way down. They may not feel quite the same eagerness on the way up. But they get that it's not actually what drives funding costs, but it still comes back to this, you know, you're profitable enough to absorb that cost. You don't have to pass on to me, the poor struggling household. So the issue for us then is to explain, and this is where it gets, you know, really difficult to get these things through in, you know, 10-second radio grabs, is, you know, why do the banks need that profitability? Why do they need the returns? What are the benefits that profitability brings to society? Because, you know, it's our first line of defence in many ways, is that profitability. You know, people often say to me, well, point out who owns the banks. The vast majority of shareholders in banks are actually retail shareholders or our superannuation. But again, a lot of people separate out the money that they're accumulating from their superannuation or their savings from, you know, what they feel they're paying on a day-to-day basis. So, So part, in essence, it's not just about explaining it. Even if we explain it, it's still considered an unpopular move.
Okay, thanks. Kevin, you had a...
Can I make a comment on that and just say, actually, the banks are getting what they deserve, in a sense, because we are one of the very few countries in the world that has interest rates on loans that are variable to whatever and whenever the banks decide. The banks have complete discretion. And you would get rid of this entire problem if the banks made their variable rate loans of the form where they linked the rate to some margin over an indicator rate and changed it only every 3 months or something of that sort. It's actually the fact that banks have complete discretion when to change interest rates and to whatever they want. And so it seems to me there's a simple solution if the banks don't like the adverse criticism, link the housing loan rates explicitly to some market indicator rate.
You want a riposte?
No. Well, I mean, it's actually one of the things that has fascinated me. I never really understood the answer, and we probably don't have time to go into it now, but why it is in Australia you have such a high supply and demand for variable loans. So it's not just the supply issues. Yeah? People have got the options to fix. Fixing, particularly in a low interest rate environment, has become more popular. We haven't got that option. My main point on that, Kevin, is you've got to be extremely careful what you tie it to. Because I know UK banks got into a lot of trouble when they tied their mortgage rates to a particular indicator rate, which wasn't an accurate representation of their true cost of funding. So they got caught very badly there. So it's not quite that straightforward.
Okay.
The banks are supposed to be specialist risk managers.
Well,
we'll leave you to slug that after.
I look forward to the paper on how to do it, Kevin. Since you can't price even the bail-in.
sorry, this... You can be next. Oh, no, you can go first.
James Hickey from Deloitte. Just to throw more fuel on that fire, maybe Kevin, you first. If the banks are targeting a 15% return on equity in a falling cash environment, they're probably getting around a 12% equity risk premium at the moment. How does that feel from an academic perspective? I know you talked about bail-in risk premium, but can we talk about equity risk premium? It links to the profitability question. How profitable is too profitable? Is a 12% equity risk premium in this market viewed as high by international standards and high by the underlying risk which the shareholders are taking?
I think the answer is it looks high, and one of the problems here is you have to actually get into the distinction between accounting and finance, because if I'm a shareholder in a bank and I want an 8% rate of return on the value of my bank shares, then if the bank's trading at a market-to-book ratio of 2, which most of them have been, then the bank management has to target 16% to get the number of dollars profits to satisfy me. So in a sense, some part of it is a reflection of the fact that we actually value our banks well above what their book ratio, the book value of their equity is. And so I think there is an issue of the accounting return versus what the market is actually valuing them at. So the real question there is, why are people valuing the banks at double book value?
Might go to webinar again, and then we'll go to you. Question for Wayne. This is a very actuarial question. You invoke the memories of, I say it the most positive way, you invoke the memories of HIH Wayne, and post-HIH, an appointed actuary role was instituted into the general insurance and other sectors. Is there any appetite, any value in instituting an appointed actuary role into banks' ADIs? And that was from Alex Marks, PwC.
Now, it's a good question. I once went to an international conference of integrated supervisory agencies, so agencies like APRA that supervise banking and insurance, and I posed that very question. Why don't we have some kind of independent role in banks? And it was just after the time of HIH. It was also the time of Equitable Life in the UK, and... the UK authorities just proceeded to tear strips off me for what a stupid idea that was, because actuaries had proven themselves to be sort of incapable in the UK. So that idea went down like a lead balloon and has never really resurfaced. I think the key here is, you know, whether you call the role an actuarial role, whether you call it the chief risk officer role, it's not really the role. I think it's the functions. And I think there is a legitimate question to ask about whether there is a need for a role somewhere in any sort of financial institution where that person is a clear member of a profession, meeting professional standards in a particular discipline. And I know there's a sort of debate around, is banking a profession? And there are those that will say, no, it's just a business. But I think parts of it, at least, are a profession. But what does that mean? Because there isn't really a professional association with professional standards and any way of actually enforcing those professional behaviours in the organisation. So that's a long-winded answer to the question, which is to say the concept has merit, but I don't... that it's not necessarily an actuarial role per se.
Okay. Steve, I've had a brainwave. Perhaps an appointed actuary could solve all the bank's problems, reputational or otherwise.
You can come back to the role then, David, after experience here.
I'd have to become an actuary first.
I'll have the office cleaned out before 6 o'clock. It's all yours.
So Peter Monkson from Bank of Queensland. To Kevin, just in terms of when you went through your paper, we didn't get to see all the wonders of all your work. Did you look at what similar instruments overseas had done or others and compare, you know, the BERPS and how other instruments, bank instruments are?
Short answer is no. I mean, that paper was purely focused on the Australian stuff. So we did look a little bit at some of the Australian overseas issues and just asking the question whether there's a difference in the pricing of those compared to the local ones. But you run into all sorts of complications because the ones that are issued into international markets don't have franking credits attached, and so you've got that immediate complication there. Short answer, no. Sorry.
Thank you. Other questions?
Just a similar question, just in terms of if you had an international investor come to say to you, I buy bank shares all around the world, I just don't understand the risks and the rewards in the Australian bank sector, how would you sort of characterise the Australian bank sector compared to international banks? Well, for example, not as well funded on the retail side and a little bit more reliant on home lending.
I think my immediate reaction is I think the Australian bank system is very sound and very, you know, very, very strong. But you can imagine that from an international investor, they look at it and they say, oh, they're bloody big building societies, as Don Argus once said. Mortgages have caused a problem in other places. They're reliant to a fair degree on international funding, although they've taken the term of that out. And I remember, I think it was Charles Littrell, I remember him putting up a graph at one stage showing that when you looked at the credit default swap pricing of the four major Australian banks, it was basically one line. They're just regarded by overseas investors as all being the same. And that does create a significant risk for the Australian economy. This is one that David Murray was very strong on, about the need to ensure that you don't, you know, the Australian banking system is regarded as unquestionably strong, so you don't have the problems that arose in the global financial crisis. And it's probably worth making the point that if you think about what happened in the global financial crisis for the Australian banks, it was actually a potential liquidity problem. It wasn't a capital problem, it was the fact that the markets just dried up. And so in that sense, capital is not the only answer, but you want to be in a situation where people, when there is a global crisis, people say, where's a safe haven? Those banks over there look pretty good. And that's part of the reason for that emphasis on unquestionably strong, which, as Wayne has said, is not just capital, it's other things as well. And good supervisors being one part of it.
And those strong banks not being subject to a Royal Commission.
Yes. Yes.
We probably have time for one more question. Is there any other questions from the floor? I have a question for Wayne. You set out your philosophy, or APRA's philosophy for regulation, your approach for regulation. How different or how similar is it to other equivalent supervisory bodies around the world? Are you part of the pack, or are you doing something different? Where are those differences? Where are those similarities? And why?
So I would say we're not unique in any way, but I would say the thing that, you know, our philosophy has always been to have excellence in supervision as our foundation. So, yes, we're called a regulation authority, but we actually talk about ourselves as a supervisor. The regulation provides a framework, but it's actually supervisors who do the work and are really the ones making judgments about risk, as distinct from, you know, the traditional view of what's a regulator. Well, they have a rule book, they have regulations, and they go along and tick off compliance or not. We see ourselves very much as supervisors, and I think my observation would be there's a cohort, a cadre of us around the world, the Canadians, the Singaporeans, a number and a couple in Scandinavia who have a similar kind of philosophy, and I'd say, you know, they also tend to align fairly well with jurisdictions that held up well in the GFC. And that's not to say it was the only reason by any means, but those that tend to follow much more rules-based approaches tended to be slow to respond, very compliance-focused, as distinct from thinking about risk, thinking about potential vulnerabilities, and encouraging people to deal with them early.
Thanks, Wayne. Well, thanks for those presentations and thanks for the questions. That was a great discussion for quite different topics. I took away these three things in summary from Kevin. Calculating and regulating for every risk can lead to an overly complex prudential regulated regime. That was my summary of it. From Wayne, very simply, orderly failure is desirable, brackets, if you have to have a failure. And from Stephen, I definitely don't want my old job back. And three is the magic number. But more seriously, it seems to me that the context for how the community views large institutions and the institutions you represent has certainly changed. So good luck. Would you please join me? I say that in the nicest possible way.
Something with orderly failure.
Yeah. Before I ask you to clap, these gentlemen, I'm going to give them each a bottle of wine. There you go.
I think they're all the same. We can fight them amongst ourselves.
If you could join me in thanking our presenters. Now, if you wouldn't mind remaining in place while we close the conference, and our president, Lindsay Smart, will make the final remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. And what a great way to end with such an engaging Q&A session. And I never would have thought that final Q&A on the Banking on Capital seminar would have drawn on appointed actuary, but there you go. So financial globalisation has greatly increased the volume and speed of international capital flows, and this has greatly assisted nations with relatively low savings pools like Australia that have traditionally needed to import capital to fund economic growth. However, as we all know, globalisation has also increased the risk of contagion from unstable financial systems that can threaten the stability of our banking system. And to reduce these risks, there's been enormous effort and thought applied to reforming financial regulation and building stronger capital frameworks. Now, as in most things, getting the balance right is critically important, and today we've heard some very thoughtful presentations on various factors that need to be taken into account when determining the appropriate level of capital to safeguard the financial system. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, the Actuaries Institute hopes to add to the policy discussion later this year when we release our paper on banking capital. Our public policy work aims to provide good objective research to better inform policy debates and hopefully improve outcomes. So I especially want to thank our final plenary speakers, Wayne Byers, Kevin Davis, and Stephen Munchenberg. All three have a significant presence within our financial system and are strong contributors to vital industry debates. So we're very indebted, gentlemen, for taking your time and to share your views on the topics that are so important to the banking sector and the broader financial system. So please join me in thanking Wayne, Kevin, and Stephen. Now, before we finish up, just a few more thank yous. So thanks again to our sponsor, SKL. We very much appreciate your support. And to our supporting partner, the Australian Bankers Association. Special thanks goes to all of the plenary speakers who've contributed their time and thought in presenting the presentations and contributing to the discussion here today. Thank you to each of the chairs who've so competently chaired the sessions. And, of course, an event like this just doesn't happen, so a big thank you to the organising committee from our banking practice committee, Peter Sinkus, Sen Nagarajan and John McClenahan. And also a thanks to the Institute's online on-site staff who've looked after all the logistics so well. So let's all give them a thank you. So there are there's the opportunity for feedback. So this is our second session. We certainly want to improve on each occasion. So I think you'll get some an email shortly, I think, to enable you to give your feedback. And so please respond to that. That's very helpful. And we look forward to seeing you at future events. Now we have some refreshments that have just been wheeled into position. And so please continue to mingle and enjoy the refreshments over the next hour or so. Thank you very much for your attendance.